welcome to On the Record with Furniture Today, a podcast that goes behind the headlines to look at the news and the newsmakers, the people and the personalities that give the furniture industry its unique flavor. I'm your host, Bill McLaughlin, Editor-in-Chief of Furniture Today. Welcome to On the Record. My guest this week is Ray Allegrezza, the current Executive Director of the International Home Furnishings Rep Association and the former Editor-in-Chief. His picture, in fact, hangs right behind my desk. Welcome, Ray.
Well, thank you. Good to be here. And don't hold my past against me.
You are the Michael Corleone of the furniture business. Every time you're out, they pull you back in. You retired. I think you got, 2.5 years of relative retirement, and now you're back involved with IFRA.
Yeah. In fact, my kids called IFRA and said, please hire him, I think Steven said something to the effect of, I don't want his brothers to see him looking like this. So here I am.
So there you are. So tell us a little bit about kind of the state of the rep business. I mean, you stepped in at a time where there's a lot going on in the industry. What's the plight of the manufacturer's rep today?
Boy, both of us being English majors, or at least, having a delight in literature, I want to say it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and it is the best of times, it is the worst of times. Reps right now have an opportunity to be more beneficial and more important to their retail customers than ever in their history, in my opinion, but they also face serious roadblocks. A lot of the business is going online. A lot of the traditional brick and mortar guys, the retailers, while they have a need for their reps, I hear quietly that they'd almost like to cut the rep out of the equation, work directly with the factory, hoping to save the 3-6% that the factory is paying the rep, and maybe squeezing the manufacturer to see if they can get that back in their pocket. So it's kind of a double-edged sword right now for the rep.
Do you think consolidation has something to do with that? When there's fewer retailers, it's a little easier for a company to pull some of that in-house and do it themselves?
Absolutely. So the reps really have fewer things to put in their bag that are meaningful. A lot of the bigger companies, as you know, have fallen by the wayside over the year or become absorbed by other companies. And so reps have basically fewer good lines to take to market. And so they're juggling 5, 6, and in some cases 7 and 8 lines. And then the challenge for each of the manufacturers that they represent is, where do I fall in the pecking order? Am I first on my rep's list? And a rep obviously plays to their strength, and they're going to play to the lines that give them the most lucrative and steady income.
The one thing, though, that a rep knows that I would think retailers want to know is what's performing. Right? I mean, everybody wants intelligence today. If Amazon is my competitor, if Wayfair is my competitor, I need to know what's selling, particularly now retail is slow. I mean, you hear it, I hear it, right? Retail it's a struggle. Reps seem to have a good idea, or I would think have a good idea of what's performing, what's going to do well.
The great reps do, and that's why the great and the good reps really are invaluable partners to the retailers. Just like in any segment of the business, you've got dirty store window retailers, and they sell furniture and they make a living. They're not great. They don't aspire to be great. They don't want to be great. They just want to make a living. With reps, they run the gamut from guys that do the minimum to reps that are as good as any individual I've seen in the furniture industry. They know their business, they know their customers' business, they know their customers' competitors' business, and they really bring this incredible value they never come to sell, they come to share and offer solutions. And that's the goal. My goal at IFRA is really, through an education program that we're looking to launch, is to really step up that level of education and professionalism so that across the board, every rep is a great rep.
You said you're looking to start an education program. What are you trying to accomplish?
Basically, back in the day, they had something called the Certified Home Rep Program, the CHR program. And that worked really well because the bulk of the manufacturing, particularly in case goods, was done where? Here. It was domestically. Mm-hmm. And your marquee brands, the Thomasville, Henrodon, Broyhill, all of the big boys, really understood that the better educated the rep was, the better it was for them. And so they would help fund the education program. They threw a lot of money into the pot, knowing that they were going to get that back. Everything, most of the furniture went offshore. Times are tougher now. Nobody's willing to write the big checks. Reps are struggling because they basically now are all independent. You know, reps have made the transition from being salaried employees of these large companies to being 1099 people, doing everything on their own. So they're struggling to finance it. The suppliers are struggling to finance it. So we're trying to come up with a cost-effective way that's going to allow our members to be better at what they do and still make it affordable for them.
It's funny, the three brands that you mentioned as examples, Henrodon, Drexel, and Broyhill, right? All of those brands are not defunct, but right. Certainly damaged.
We're looking for a kind word to describe.
We are looking for a politically friendly way of saying, I mean, Broyhill apparently has a landing place. We'll be hearing, I think you'll probably be seeing that brand pop up at Big Lots not too soon.
But even that, and to take nothing away from Big Lots, Big Lots is not what you would consider initially to be a premier branded retailer. And at one point, Broyhill was, my God, if maybe not the Cadillac, certainly the Oldsmobile of the industry. So it's kind of interesting how that marriage ended.
Well, and Drexel had stores, right? I mean, there were Drexel dealers who carried that brand and were proud to use, you know, proud to carry that brand, and now not so much.
Right.
I want to circle back to that. We're going to come back in a little while, talk a little bit about history and look at how that has evolved. But I want to talk a little bit, because you and I had been talking about young people coming into the business. And this is a challenge across the whole furniture industry. I think retailers are struggling with that. The next generation of furniture, you know, the young people don't want to take over the family business. So there's a lot of them that are, you know, closing or getting out or going away. I think manufacturers are struggling. How do you get young people in? If you're a rep, I mean, there are not a lot of young reps.
And here's why. If you come out of college and get a sales and marketing job for a manufacturer, be it domestic or someone that's sourcing from overseas, you're salaried. If you work for a retailer, you're salaried. To my point earlier, you come out of school, you probably have some debt from your college loans, and you want to go on the road because you can be your own boss, set your own hours, and really launch your own business. For that first year and a half to 2 years, you write every check. So if I'm calling on you and you're 200 miles away and I need a hotel and I want to take you to dinner and we want to do this, I'm paying for everything. And so the challenge right now is that young people who've expressed interest in going on the road and becoming, we don't even like to use the word rep anymore. We want to upgrade it to sales and marketing professional, because ideally that's what they are. So we are looking for ways right now. I'm in conversations, believe it or not, with the Small Business Association, SBA, to see if there's a way that we can secure some low interest government loans so these kids could be self-funded, have some skin in the game. Nobody's just writing them a check and say, here, go try it. And if it doesn't work, too bad, so sad. Basically, they would have a little, they'd have some skin in the game because it would be a low interest loan, but that they would have to repay. But they could pay themselves while they're growing their business. So we're having conversations. They're very preliminary at this point. But I cannot think of any other way to encourage young people to become reps and eliminate that year to year and a half where they have to write every check on their own.
I wonder if there's a way that companies, like the U.S. Army or the Armed Services, right? So you agree to a certain amount of time and they'll fund your education and do that. I wonder if maybe there are some forward-looking manufacturers out there that would agree to fund a year or two of a young person in exchange for you're going to give me X number of years after at some kind of rate. I wonder if that would...
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about history. It'd be great. We could have like a new breed of indentured servants. No, but seriously, there's got to be some out-of-the-box thinking to help young people come in, at least on the rep side, because the big challenge, the big obstacle is, I know I have had personal conversations, one of which is my son, who is currently in the business, who really found the idea of setting his own hours and being his own boss appealing, but we couldn't crack that obstacle of how does he pay for his family and his mortgage and all the associated bills of life while he grows a business for a year and a half to 2 years.
And poor him, he had to settle for a director of e-commerce for a $1 billion motion company. Tough life, poor kid.
What can I tell you?
Stephen, if you're listening, my heart, this is a very tiny violin I'm playing for you, young man. He's a very good kid. And it's good that he found his way into such a great situation.
Yeah, I'm happy for him.
So, all right, let's talk about how I ended up here. I am now sitting in what once was kind of your office. Your picture is on my wall.
I have your picture in my wallet.
I'm sure my wife will be pleased to hear that. Mm. But in all seriousness, you came here in 1997. You were from a place that you and I worked together. We were both at HFN way back when. Ironic that we now own HFN.
It's crazy when you think about it.
Isn't it, though? Yeah, it is. I mean, and you were the competitor back then. Right?
I was.
So you came here as the competitor. What was that like when you first came in the office and from the competition?
Well, I don't want to say that it was rough, but you see the windows you have here? At the end of the day, especially before it would get dark in the winter, I would check and make sure my tires weren't slashed. So I honestly can't say that I was welcome with open arms. Furniture Today, up until that point, pretty much had a tradition that they did not hire from the competition. But the challenge was they needed a category that I had helped develop at HFN, which was ready to assemble category, and we kind of owned that, and they tried many times to just basically wrestle that business from us, and they couldn't, so they figured the easiest way was just bring me over, and that's pretty much what happened.
Isn't that funny, right? Walmart couldn't get into e-commerce the way they want. They bought Jet. Furniture Today had trouble getting into RTA. They hired you.
They bought me.
What a bargain.
Yeah.
RTA, I mean, that category's been around since the 50s, right? Wasn't it Erie Sauter who came up with some of the first places?
Exactly.
But I was having a conversation recently with a major furniture manufacturer, an executive from it, and his opinion is that RTA is going to be the future of the furniture business, because if you can't ship it on e-commerce, that e-commerce is going to become so important, whether it's to a brick and mortar store or to a pure play, e-commerce is going to become so important that you have to be able to knock it down and ship it. Isn't it ironic that all these years later?
I'm not sure which major shared that with you, but if he has a penchant for orange jackets, I would say he's absolutely right. And they used to tease me back in the day. They said that I was the poster child for ready to assemble furniture, because I would point out to them that because it came unassembled and had to be assembled by the consumer, the tolerances had to be more precise than with fine case goods. And I still hold that to this day. And as more and more product is being sold online, I've had conversations with people who have been responsible for developing e-commerce businesses, and they've said to me, what's the one thing I need to do? I said, stop picturing the end product, what it looks like. Start by picturing the box. Design from the box, the UPS box, backwards. You have to think totally different. Because it, to that person's point, it's got to be UPSable. And so you can't think about the product and then try to jam it in the box. You think about the box, and then you basically work backwards. And get your finished product that way.
Well, isn't that funny? Some of the companies that we know that are particularly good at logistics start with the container, right? How is it going to fit in the container and design backwards from there? How am I going to pack it? How am I going to ship it? And this is the exact mindset.
The smart people have always realized that. One of the things that impressed me years ago, Keith Koenig at one of the leadership conferences, somebody said to him, how does it feel to be, you know, one of the leading furniture retailers? He said, you know, in that Keith voice, well, I'm really not. I'm in the logistics business. The boxes just happen to contain furniture. That's why guys like Keith Koenig are successful, I think, because they see the bigger picture.
And still successful to this day, still innovating, still doing creative things.
It's in his DNA, you know?
That's the great thing about this business. There are some people who are just so innovative, so forward-looking, always looking at new ideas, new ways to push the business. You must have seen a lot of that. Who were some of the, like over the last 20 years that you've been in the business, who were some of the people? Obviously, Keith is one of them. I think you alluded to Ron Wanek at Ashley.
Absolutely. 1 year at leadership, I had this young, nice young guy that nobody ever heard of, and he stood up in front of the old guard, and he said, I want to thank Ray Allegres and Furniture today for having me here at leadership. My name is Nur Shah, and I'm with CSN, and you guys are going to laugh at me, but we're going to sell a lot of furniture online. And they were rude. They laughed out loud and like, you know, into their hands. And he said, and you know, but Nurse held his ground and he said, we're not just selling little pieces. We're selling sofas. And this was years and years and years ago. He's one example that always comes to mind.
$3 billion later.
Yeah. Who's laughing now, I guess, yeah. I would say, right? Yeah. Jim McInvale at Gallery, with the crazy promotions, but with the figuring out ways to get big, bulky furniture in Texans' homes in Houston, you know, coming through the windows, this and that. I mean, crazy Mattress Mac ads aside, he was one of the innovators with home delivery, as was El Dorado, you know, pushed that. And a lot of these guys just got out early.
You know what I find funny with Mac? He makes it sound like it's such an... I mean, you hear him talk about it, and he says, how do you do same-day delivery? You throw it in a truck, and you follow him home. And it makes it sound like, gee, of course you do. You throw it in a truck. But the kind of volume that he does, the kind of scale that he achieves... It's not quite so simple as throwing in a truck. I mean, he jokes about it and he makes it sound simple and easy, but he and his team are brilliant in terms of executing logistics at scale.
Well, you just made me think of something. The common thread that all my furniture heroes and heroines have is in a very predictable, humdrum business, they did the unpredictable and the unthinkable. Think about it. I mean, we could take that metric and put it to Nurge, to Keith, to Wanek, to Ron Wanek.
Oh, yeah, GMROI.
To El Dorado. El Dorado one day comes over in a little boat and says, you know what? I mean, maybe they didn't say it as they were rowing over in the El Dorado, but I bet you they said, you know what? We are going to own the Hispanic market, you know, and more. And they did. So for every great story, there was just a great idea. And they were willing to act on it. And that's the difference. This industry, I'm probably going to get hate mail for this, but, you know, by and large, this industry runs the risk of being an industry of followers. I can't tell you how many times when I was at the paper and I'd be working market and I'd kind of overhear the conversations. And even some smart retailers, they'd come and they'd kind of whisper to the guy they were visiting, what's selling? What has my competitor got? What's working for them? And I always used to think, that's crazy, because now you're going to come back with the same thing he already has. It's going to come down to who's got the lowest price. You're going to lose. Your competitor loses. The consumer's going to win, and she's still going to feel like she's getting screwed. And so I don't get that mentality, you know. And so the smart guys would come and say, what do you got in the back room? What can we dream up together? Another guy that's an innovator and is my hero is... the guy with Handy Living.
Oh, Tom Erdman.
Tom Erdman. Under the radar, has the chutzpah to design purple sofas, like purple cows, and sells a ton of them.
You know what I find interesting in all of these things? I mean, other than they're all innovators, all of them seem to have an innate understanding of the consumer, whether it's what makes it easier to get it home, convenience to the consumer, what makes it easier in Nerd's case for the consumer to shop, what's the consumer's price need, right? What's their price value relationship? And you talk about Tom understanding the internet, right? I mean, that's his, he understands that consumer and that piece. And it's so funny that everybody today talks about UX, right? User experience. Like this is, that's the big new buzzword in the industry today. I was reading an article just the other day about the new CEO at Ford is a former Steelcase guy. And he's bringing all of this user experience data to Ford, and they're looking at cars in entirely new ways. And it's funny because there's, if you look at the really successful guys in the furniture business, they're people who start with understanding the consumer and then work backwards.
So exactly.
Right, everything comes full circle.
And, you know, here's something, and I don't have the data to back it up, but this is just a gut reaction. We all, if you listen carefully to the furniture industry, you know, as the sun sets, you hear the knocking of knees and the gnashing of teeth. Because the consumer, she's armed, she's dangerous, she knows more than we do. You know what? My gut tells me from, like, spending a lot of time in furniture stores, the consumer, she, he, they come in, they don't have a clue what they want until something hits them. It's like that Supreme Court's just definition of pornography. You know, I can't define it, but I know when I see it. The consumer, a lot of times they come in, they know they want a sofa, but they don't know. I don't care how much time they spend online. They may have an idea of like what they want to spend or what they think it looks like, but they go to that sales floor or they go online and then it's something speaks to them. So the thing is, I think we just have to like lightened up about the consumer, you know, we got to get into her mind. Now, we just got to get into her field of sight. You know, I mean, we are disposable.
That is the thing that I think is really scary about Wayfair and Amazon. And everybody talks about the price and the fact that, you know, Wayfair is not profitable and that Amazon Consulting's at crazy prices. But I think the thing that they're really scary good at is being in front of the consumer. If you look at Amazon's model, I have argued for years that Amazon is not and never has intended to be a retailer. And if you thought that you were going to judge them on a retail metrics, you missed it. Amazon is a digital real estate operator, right? They own digital real estate space. And what they're going to do is control the on-ramp for the consumer. Right now, most product searches, more product searches start on Amazon than any other search engine. So if you want to be in front of the consumer, Amazon is going to control that on-ramp. I want to get in front of, you know, exactly, Jane and John Doe. Well, how do I do that? Now I'm going to, you know, Amazon's going to have the toll booth. Oh, sure, you can do it. And here's the toll. Come through us. And I think Wayfair, when you hear about them talking in their financial calls, it's always about we are investing in customer acquisition. And what that means is we're making sure that the consumer starts with us. They're going to come to us first when they think about this. And I think furniture retailers really have to figure out, what's your on-ramp? How do you get in front of the customer?
And the interesting thing, if the statistics are to be believed, the bulk of sales are still made in store in furniture.
Well, I think this year the number is 20% is direct-to-consumer, right? Boxed beds. And I think the internet is now 15%. 13 to 15%. Well, the flip side of that is 85% is not, right? I mean, okay, I'm gonna divide this pie, right? Would you like 15% of the pie? Or would you like 85% of the pie? I'm a fat guy, I want the big piece, right? So there's plenty of business to be done out there. It's just a matter of how you do it and
Yeah. And you know, one of the things we used to do at Leadership, and this was always like one of my favorite panels, Hometown Heroes. And I'd find a guy, and not necessarily was a top 100, but he was successful as hell. And had, because of his connection to his local market and the give backs and whatever else they were doing, they were unshakable. You couldn't dislodge those. Bigger guys would come into town, and there was something about, and even the young people, which I used to find interesting. You know, we talked to the younger people in the town, and they'd say, you know, my God, I turned my back on everything my parents have done. They said black, I bought white. They ate rice, I wanted cuckoos, you know. But when it comes to this, I still want to shop with this guy because they created, there was something there that they created.
It's funny, we honored Darvin's last year at the leadership conference. You want to talk about two nicer, I mean, there's just not two nicer people than Steve and Marty Darden. You want to talk about somebody who's in a tough market. I mean, competing in Chicago, you know, Bob's is there now, Art Van is there.
Walter E. Smith, you got, who's not there, really?
Exactly,
right?
That's a tough market. I mean, well, you got me Crate and Barrel, you got Resto there. And yet, those guys are a fixture, right? They own their space in the market, they know their consumer, they invest in their community, they support their community. And let's go back to Jim McInvale. He's taking part of his stores now and using them as community centers.
Right.
And the way he opened up the stores last year in the hurricanes. Didn't blink an eye, didn't think about it, didn't say, don't put your feet on the furniture. It's, you know, my store is your home. Please let me do for you. I can't imagine anybody in Houston who experienced that who's not going to be a lifelong gallery customer.
You know, and while they become fixtures and they're hard to unseat, the other common denominators, they're never static. Darwin's is always doing something different. McInvale's always doing something different. They know that they can't take anything for granted. You know, in furniture, like in life, the only constant is change. And so they maintain and isolate and reinforce all the good stuff that made them the hometown hero. But then they create nice side dishes around that main dish, and they keep making it appetizing, and you keep wanting to come back to see what's for dinner.
Yeah,
leave it to an Italian. You know, always everything's got to come back to food.
An overweight Irishman.
Yeah, pie dinner. You know.
Yeah, most of my analogies are sports or food.
Exactly.
Okay, just to remind everybody, my guest today is Ray Allegrezza, former editor in chief of Furniture Today, lifelong friend, and the current executive director of IFRA. Would not be a conversation if we didn't talk about some of the things that we have had in common and some of the things that we have shared. You've, I think, shared as people. When I got here, I'll share this. The number one question that people asked me was not, did I know anything about the furniture industry? It was, did I play the guitar? I think you're as famous for playing the guitar as anything else. And you still play.
I still play. In fact, we're going to be, well, since I've been with the paper, twice a year, every market, a band called Southern Chill, made up mostly of Klausner furniture execs, do a benefit for City of Hope. So we're going to be doing that again this time. And, of course, I'm going to lean on you to put an ad in about where we're playing. It's probably going to be at Blue Bourbon Jack.
We're always happy to support City of Hope.
And, the music is integral. It's as important as this job was. I mean, they were both really big chunks of my life.
Well, we're going to do something interesting this year. You probably saw last year we introduced a people issue for the first time, and we honored different people throughout the industry. We are going to do a spread this year on I Could Have Been a Rock Star. And we're asking, so anybody who is listening, if you are in the furniture business and you play an instrument, send me a picture of you playing an instrument. So we're going to put your picture in the paper. You'll be in the paper again.
Oh,
and Jake Jabs and Jeff Arditti at Aria Plays and Jerry Borgini play. So we want to get as many pictures as we can because it's remarkable how many people in the furniture industry are just phenomenal musicians.
Yeah.
You know, Andy Sokol. Have you ever heard Andy Sokol play?
Sweet
play
Andy, the blues, the harmonica.
Oh my goodness, mm-hmm. Yes. Just, I could sit and listen to him play the jazz harmonica for hours. So I have to get a picture. If anybody has a picture of Andy Sokol, send us that. It's just remarkable how many people in the furniture industry play. So one of the things that you and I shared early on was a love of some of the same literature. And I think the book that we've passed back and forth, A Prayer for Owen Meany, right? I actually gave that to Clint Engel for his daughter, and she read that. It's one, when people ask me for a recommendation, it's John Irving. For those of you who don't know, it's 25 years old, but it's a really brilliant piece of literature. Are you reading anything interesting now? You have anything to share with me or our readers, or what are you reading? I read a lot of business books now.
Well, I'm trying to figure out the future, both my own and that of the country and the world, by going back to, I've been doing a lot of studying after hours about ancient Sumer, Sumerian culture, and all the things that they really gave to us. You know, the delineation of time and months, and these people, you think you and I write, these people were crazy with their cuneiforms. They wrote everything down, how they made love, 16 recipes for beer, crazy stuff. So I've been doing a lot of interesting reading about their civilization, which was crazy because in some of the cuneiforms they have all the planets correctly identified, like before there were telescopes. So it's like, how did they do that? The other thing that I just got done, and boy, this was a mind bender, was Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor. And it was just such cool stuff. I mean, it was hundreds and hundreds of pages, but then if he had like a summary chapter, it was like, just do the work, don't complain. Do work. It's good for you. Don't worry about what other people say. Never let your ego get bigger than your talents. I mean, just, he was incredible with this really practical, down-to-earth stuff. So,
it's so funny that those are things that you read now in so many leadership and self-help books, right? And yeah. And there it is, ancient wisdom. I keep a copy of Sun Tzu's Art of War on my desk, just by my computer. And every once in a while, just for inspiration, I'll just kind of open it up and read a page or two. You know, that's ancient, right? I don't know if you know Simon Sinek. People who follow me on LinkedIn know I'm a huge fan. He wrote the book Leaders Eat Last, which I thought was fascinating. He talks about the concept of servant leadership. You're a big advocate of servant leadership. I think it was something you practiced yourself.
Well, it just felt right. Mm-hmm. And I always would tell the people on the staff, I would never ask any of those people to do anything that I wouldn't do. If it meant writing cut lines, washing the windows. And we had that whole culture here, though. I mean,
Furniture Today has always been a culture of doers,
yeah. Right?
Worker bees, and jump in whatever the task is, right?
And the more we were told it couldn't be done, the more we said, bring it, you know?
Isn't that fun?
It was. It is. It's, you know, you're in a good spot. And, you know, the industry still really rely so heavily on this brand to make sense out of what's going on.
It's such a dynamic time. People don't know this, but I mean, because you started here in 1997, I dug out the top 100 lists from 1997.
Crazy.
Right? Heilig Meyer's number one, Levitt's number two, Sears Home Life. How ironic that Sears was a top 100 retailer in 1997. And today, I think they're down to 200 stores and they're just a fire sale and a financial play by somebody who has managed to turn their assets into his windfall.
But, yeah.
It's such a dynamic industry.
And you could look at the list and you could, even though there were extenuating circumstances in each of the demises, by and large, they were powerful industry leaders that forgot to lead. And along the way, they lost their way. And while they stopped and looked over their shoulder to try to figure out who the hell they were and where they should be, they got trampled. Sears, I mean, near the end, what did it stand for? Maybe Craftsman Tools, but then even that went away?
Yeah.
You know? And so how do you have a home life store when maybe old people think of you for, you know, hammers and Craftsman Tools and Levitt's and Heilig Meyer's? I mean, my God,
It's nice to see some names, though, still there. I mean, I see Haverty's here, right? They were number five in 1998.
Yeah.
Rooms to Go, still right in that top 10 list.
Schottenstein family still around.
Yeah.
So Art Van.
People who remain committed to the furniture business. And you know, I think in every case, and I think the jury is kind of out on, right, on Art Van just because there's new ownership there. And so we'll see if they kind of continue that legacy. But, I mean, these are all companies, Haverty's. All companies that understand who they are have a very clear vision, a very clear mission statement. And I also, when I think of the leadership of these companies, incredible humility.
Yeah. And resiliency. Because all of these companies that are still around, let's face it, just like here at the paper, I made some boners. I made some big mistakes. But we had, I guess everybody here had the ability to regroup, rethink, and resolve. You know, I mean, all these companies had miscues. They all went on down a road that was a dead end. But it didn't kill them. They had resiliency, and they were able, because they had good people around them too.
Well, it's funny. I think that's that. You look at who's on the top of the list today.
Yeah.
And it's Ashley, right? And if you were to ask Ron or Todd Wanek, what do they talk about? They talk about all of the reinventions. I think the number is 18 reinventions. Right, they talk about, Ron talks about the 1982 moment when he went to a trade show and he saw these Chinese made occasional tables, and he looked and he said, those guys are going to put us out of business. And so he went over to China, figured out, opened up manufacturing, and figured out, I mean, completely reinvented the company. Just the last couple of years, they've been in the middle of a technological reinvention where, again, they're reinventing. I mean, that's embedded in their culture, right?
Right.
That idea. So when you talk about resiliency and all these other folks, okay, how do you get to be number one? Reinvention, resiliency, you know, reinvent yourself.
Exactly. And I would take another spin on that word. And it is reinvention, but I love the word reimagine, because they really do. You know, they have the ability to remember where they had been, understand where they are now, and have that uncanny ability to see around the corner and reimagine what that's going to look like, and start acting like that today. You know, that's what great companies do.
Yeah, I'll tell you, this is a wonderful, fun time to cover the furniture business. I thank you for the gift of the opportunity to work in this business and with the staff, because, oh my goodness, there's so much fun, really exciting stuff going on in the furniture business.
No, man, I'm going to embarrass you, but like when I decided I wanted to retire and just do some different things, the untold story is that I was relentless. And you're like, what furniture magazine? North Carolina? No, go away. And then I would like be quiet for a month. And, hey, Bill. Because I just really felt that you would bring the right toolbox to this company.
Okay, so the Mutual Admiration Society, right? I'll share my flip side of that is, so much of that toolbox I learned sitting next to you back in the early 90s at Homeworld Business. I can remember sitting next to you, and I've told a couple people this story, but sitting next to you and listening to you have conversations with CEOs. And in a lot of cases, it was, you know, Dan O'Sullivan or Mike Gustorf, right? The RTA
guys. Kevin Souder, yeah.
Kevin
Souder,
or the RTA guys. And you're talking about baseball. And you're talking about your kid's Little League game. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, how the hell is this guy getting stories done? He's sitting there BSing with these guys. And then you'd produce a story, and there were these brilliant, insightful quotes. And what it was is you were engaging them in a conversation. You had a relationship that went beyond, I have five questions I want to ask you, and my first question is. And I have taken that very much to heart, right? That focus on building a relationship, engaging people in a conversation. Just have a conversation. And all of it flows from that. And I now, something I learned from you, I now share with young reporters when we have interns or young reporters come. I will share the story of sitting next to you. I tell that story. I hope I haven't embarrassed you.
No, but it was genuine. I mean, the last market, I still went and chatted 20 minutes with Kevin Souder. I mean, this industry will give you the opportunity to forge lifelong relationships with some pretty awesome people. And Kevin and I were talking about his kids and the business, and it's genuine. You know, I mean, once I was out of the business, if I really didn't enjoy those relationships, there'd be no reason to continue them. I mean, hell, I sneak back here whenever they let me in, just because it's home, you know?
Yeah. So talking about interviews, right? I mean, we both have interviewed people for 30 years. That was kind of what we do for a living. If you could interview anyone in history, going back to whatever time you want, I mean, from caveman through present day, if you could interview anyone, who would you want to interview?
I only get one, huh?
Well, no, take as many as you want. Who, what kind of people, who would you like to interview?
Well, there's a guy that, he was born a Jew and became a Roman citizen named Josephus. And he wrote this incredible history that talked about the historical Jesus and the historical Pontius Pilate and this and that. I'd be cool to, like, have lunch with him I guess, well, have a bagel. We'd have a bagel and say, you know, what really happened? What went on? And of course, you know, it's funny. I grew up Roman Catholic,
okay,
very involved in my church. Now I'm in a period of my life where I'm very close to meeting whatever's up there, and I still don't know what the hell it is. And so I would love to have talked to, I would love to have talked to Jesus. And I would have loved to see what happened in the tomb if that stone rolled away or somebody snatched his body. I would love to have talked to Buddha, to Muhammad, a lot of these great spiritual people. I would have loved to talk to those kids who saw the apparition at Fatima and said, what were you kids smoking when you weren't in school? I would just love to know a lot of stuff that I and most of us will never know. So there's a ton of people. I would have loved to talk to Kennedy, JFK. I mean, I just have read book after book after book about his tragedy with Bay of Pigs and being misled, and watching him recover from that, you know. And I just like would have said, you know what, I would have gotten in the damn car in Dallas and taken one in the back of the head just so you could have continued on, because I really would have loved to seen what kind of president he would have become. There's so many people, you know, my God.
I think about this a lot.
What about you?
Well, I think about it a lot, especially when I'm putting together the leadership conference, right? Because you're always interested in how people lead. So from that standpoint, I would love to have interviewed and all of the same people that you mentioned, but Abraham Lincoln. How do you lead at a time when the country is more divided even than today, right? We talk about as if things are so divided. Well, it was so divided then that people literally picked up guns and, right, you had that whole, how do you lead in that kind of environment? How do you motivate people? I would love to have talked to George Washington, because you take on a job. I took this job, there was a blueprint, right? There were processes in place, there were precedents, there was history. If you're the first one to do something, how do you do that? How do you come up with, where do you start? I would love to have known how you come up with that. So, you know, people like that. I would love to have interviewed Mother Teresa, because I would love to know where her patience comes from. Where does that ability to just give of yourself so selflessly in such difficult times?
You know, I bet you would have said, Bill, if I can explain it, it doesn't count. You know, I mean, yeah. Incredible choices. But the cool thing in the seat you're in now is you do get to talk to a wide variety of...
Some really smart people. And the great thing about the furniture business, and I've been a journalist for 30 years, and I've never... By the way, those of you who are listening, that's one of the books just fell off the table. Please ignore that noise.
That was 1978.
1978 just hit the floor. no, but the furniture industry is so open. I have never in all my career, I've covered consumer electronics, photography products, housewares, vacuum cleaners, appliances, never found an industry where so many people are willing to give of themselves and share information with you and share of themselves. It's
a
great industry.
Me telling you when you took over, we were saying, like, you know, do's and don'ts and stuff. And I said to you, Bill, you've known me a long time, so you know I'm not blowing smoke. I ain't the brightest bulb in the box. And I got really tight with these people with one line. I'm trainable. You know, I'm teachable and I'm trainable, and I really want to understand your business. I have never found an industry more anxious to mentor and to help. And maybe selfishly, you know, they're like the old manufacturers that used to pay for the rep training. You know, maybe they said, well, the more this guy knows, the better it is for me. But I just think it was inherently, this is an industry of givers. I mean, you could talk, forget just about time and ideals. I mean, look what they do with City of Hope and the money that they raise each year, millions and millions of dollars. It's a great industry. It really is. That's why I kept trying to convince you before you came down here. These are some of the coolest people you'll ever meet and nicest.
Which is why I think people don't leave. And even after they retire.
Well, yeah, I know.
Here they are, right? And I think that's the perfect place to end. So till next week, we'll see you. I'm Bill McLaughlin. This is Ray Alegreza. You'll see us around market. Have a good week.